Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I am at the Public Interest in Environmental Law Conference in Eugene, Oregon at the university. And I've just heard John Stryker speak on a climate change panel. There are many, many things going on here. It's just overwhelming numbers of workshops and tons of information about the environment, which, of course, is the number one issue of the day, I would say. And John Stryker is from Canada. He is the head of the Northern Climate Exchange. He lives in the Yukon. The Northern Climate Exchange is about independent information, shared information, and understanding on climate change. And we've just been chatting a bit here. And I want to welcome you, John, first off.
Thanks, Sue. It's nice to be here.
You've done many things in your life and still are doing many things, including being an artist. And you've lived in various different countries. We just discovered we both lived in Trinidad. You've taught, and now you live in a cabin in the Yukon, and must be very quiet there.
Yeah, it is. We live on the headwaters of the Yukon River, and I met my wife there, and she's been living there for 20 years now. And I mean, in the cabin before there was running water or power or telephone, We're in a small community, and we're at the quiet end of that community. We're the last cabin on the lake, but there's another 20 miles of lake to the south of us that we can just go out and paddle and explore. It's beautiful.
I bet it is. Well, I particularly wanted to talk to you because you said how important, which I already sort of know, that what happens in that part of the world is affecting the whole rest of the world. And you hear about the glaciers melting at this very, very fast rate, and everything is moving along faster and faster and faster. It seems to be gaining speed in terms of climate change, which couldn't be more crucial and upsetting and scary. And actually, you were getting choked up, and I can so relate to that because it's very intense stuff, and people don't usually do emotional work. I think that's one of the reasons that there's not more citizen involvement in things, because everybody's so busy pushing down their feelings, if they even have any idea about how bad it is. Would you say how bad it is? Here, I know sure. People want to hear good news, but first they have to, you know, get reality, I think.
Yeah, I mean, no matter what I'm honest to, I attempt, at the very least, to be honest to the truth, that really elusive thing out there. And yet, I think it's very important that whatever we say, I mean, as an example, people will tell you that there are a lot more deaths due to heat because of climate change. And that's true, but you also need to offset that with how many deaths we don't have because of cold now with climate change. So it's important for us not to misrepresent the truth. I think it's what gives us our democracy. And I'm not afraid to show my emotion about it, or it's not about being afraid or not. It's I'm not really able to control that emotion or passion, and I allow it as long as I feel like I'm being as honest and fair with things as possible. So how big is the problem? I think it's the biggest problem that the world faces, and I've thought about that a lot, and my conclusion is based on the fact that climate change is so broad and so systemic and also so difficult to put your finger on sometimes on our day-to-day lives and the timescales that we live and work and think, and we all like it a little bit warmer too. And that's one of the nice things about it, I guess. But the changes that it brings are generally disruptive. And whenever you disrupt an ecosystem, then it takes a lot of time to come back. And so for human beings, where we have all of this infrastructure invested in the world, and as Robert Kennedy just said last night in a talk, that in many ways nature is part of our infrastructure. It's a vital part of our infrastructure. Sunlight and the greenhouse itself helps to keep us warm. That's important. But we're putting those things out of balance right now. And by putting them out of balance, we're disrupting all of these systems, and it's going to come back to us in a hard way. The sorts of things that we can expect will be the ability to produce food and access to water, and I think a little bit later it'll be sea level rise, which causes people to be displaced, so we'll have some forced migration because of that. But before that happens, as sea levels start to rise, we'll be getting more storms which cause damage, because just a small increase in water levels, a small increase in the energy of storms coming from the heat in oceans, that will tend to cause a lot more damage. Now, the way that it works with the Arctic is that up in the Arctic, as we see these changes coming, they actually have impacts for the rest of the world. And that's one of the reasons that I've had so much opportunity to go around the world and speak to people about what's going on in the Arctic. And the way it works is that the Arctic helps to cool the rest of the world. And as we lose the Arctic ice, and it is going fairly fast, we actually accelerate climate change across the rest of the world. And we know this already from the evidence. The Arctic is warming at twice the rate of the rest of the global average. And where I live in the Yukon and another place in Siberia, it's actually been warming at three times the rate. And that's the warmest that it's been increasing in the world. And those things have this impact back on the rest of the globe.
But I don't know about most of the listeners. I've been reading a lot of emails about the polar bears, and it's just so super heartbreaking. And of course, these things just really are affecting the animals and plants, not to mention the people. I wonder if you could speak a bit about the people. Are you where you can see these changes personally on a monthly, daily, whatever it is, basis?
Yep, I can see them on a daily basis. I mean, the most obvious impact that we see where I live is that there's been a beetle which actually takes advantage of climate change and has been very prolific lately. It's the spruce bark beetle where I live, but it's the mountain pine beetle in the northwestern states. But the spruce bark beetle is, because of a drought, able to burrow quicker through the trees, and because of the longer seasons, has two reproductive cycles. And most importantly, I think, because there's been no cold winters, it hasn't had a dieback. And that beetle has killed over the southwestern forests of the Yukon, it's killed 80% of that forest. 80% is standing dead. When you look at the forest, you will just see gray rather than green. And so that is a very visible impact that we can all see. In the eastern Arctic, I live in the northwest of Canada, next door to Alaska. In the eastern Arctic, over on islands like Baffin Island and heading towards Greenland, that's where what people will see is the sea ice going out. A year and a half ago, I was on a teaching expedition that was going from Reykjavik to Greenland to Baffin Island, and I was there with 50 American students and 50 Canadian students and another half dozen students from around the world. These are high school students. We were doing experiential learning out in the Arctic, and we went into a tiny community called Pengnertung. And there we met one of the elders, and his name is Joannesi Karpik, and he's an Inuk elder, and he spoke to us in Inuktitut, and that was translated for us, and he told us a story about the sea ice. So the Inuit people there use the sea ice, they read it, they understand it, they work with it, it's an integral part of their culture. And Joannesi explained that in around the mid-90s, and they're an oral tradition, so they pass these stories on, and I was lucky enough to get this story passed to me. But in the 1990s, somewhere in the middle of the 90s, they started to notice that the sea ice in their bay in Pangnirtung was going out earlier. Normally it leaves in June or July. And the year that we were there, it had gone out at the beginning of March. And the way to sort of look at this, for you and I, is that, say, around the middle of March, we were snowbound and couldn't go to a grocery store, and then we didn't get out till June or July. How much of an impact would that have? Lots. Now, that culture won't die out, but because the culture is based on language and land, the culture itself will change. So the people will have to move over to a Western economic basis rather than a subsistence or traditional lifestyle. I mean, it's already been happening a lot, and climate change is just accelerating it. So I asked Joannessy if there was something that we could do to help. And his response to me, he gestured with his hand in the air to say, could I please write about it? And I did, so I wrote an article called Sila. And Sila is an Inuktitut word, which means weather, but it also means the outside, and it in some ways means the universe, and it kind of means the external, the part that you can't control, something that's outside of your control. So it has all these meanings which are important on this subject. So I wrote an article called Sila and published it. And about a year, well, just actually about a month ago, so this is a year and a half after being there in the Arctic with Joannessy.
Which we could say when it is right now, it is sure. The beginning of March 2007, since time is rolling along.
Yeah, this is the 2nd of March 2007. And I was there in the 1st of August 2005. And a year and a half after that, out comes this report by the Canadian Ice Service. And they used satellite data. And they saw that an ice shelf sort of due north of where we were in the Arctic, on the tip of Ellesmere Island, at the northernmost point of Canada land, and nearly the northernmost point of anywhere in the world land. And there is an ice shelf there called the Ailes Ice Shelf. And within an hour, it broke away. Well, that ice is already floating, so it's not going to change sea levels, but it's a significant chunk of ice. It was 25 square miles, and it took 1 hour for it to go. So when these things go, sometimes they go in a very fast way. And it just struck me because we find this out later, and it happened just, I think it was within 2 weeks of me talking to Joannessy about sea ice and those issues, and then all of a sudden I find out it's gone, and it brought me back to it and made me think about it again. And it's important because once that ice goes, then the ice that's on the land, the glaciers on the land, start to move a lot faster, and those things do add to sea level rise. And so it's, you used the term earlier, and the indigenous peoples of the north have a saying, and there's even been a book written under this title, and it's that the earth is faster now.
Meaning that things are moving faster.
Yeah, for sure they are. And I mean, in some ways, that's, you know, there's some sides of that that are good, and there's some sides of that that are bad. I mean, it just depends on what it is that we're doing. When I try to... Usually when I talk about climate change and sort of all the very disruptive impacts that are coming and are now being felt and will be coming to areas further south, and the message that I bring, a lot of times, like just a couple of days ago, I was at Willamette University and speaking to a class of first-year environmental studies students. And so I asked them what they felt after we'd started talking. And I got impending doom, you know, deep anxiety, all these things. So then I asked them to go through a mind game with me, and I said to them, okay, we're 2007, and I wrote up 1957, and I wrote up 1907. So that's 50 years ago and 100 years ago. And let's talk about how much change has happened between then and now. And then I asked them to just think about it for a second and say to me, if we had that much change in the last 100 years, do you think we will have more change or less change in the next 100 years? And to a person, they all said, more change. And then I said to them, now what you need to do is imagine that that change is by our choice. Because it is all by our choice. Now, I get that there are other things that motivate us, and so we will always be competing. But that's the vision that we could have, and it's there. And in fact, we'll have to move faster than 100 years because climate change is such a big problem. We really need to be working on it very soon. And all change, all work on it is important, but it is within our potential. That's what I want people to know and believe and start reacting to.
I want to remind people that I'm speaking with John Stryker, and he is from Canada, lives in the Yukon. He's a scientist, engineer, and artist, and you're hearing about his experience and opinions, and I'm really happy to be able to talk to him today here at the Public Interest in Environmental Law Conference in Eugene, Oregon. So what do you think? I hear about what we should be doing, but I'm not sure everybody even hears about it. I'm not sure even most people take any interest or have information from the media, at least in the United States. So anyway, John Stryker, please tell us what you think are the most important things that we can do.
Well, Sue, the problem has come from human beings. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just released its fourth assessment report. These are all the top scientists from around the world working on consensus, and they came out and said, first of all, that climate change is very real and very serious. And they cited, for example, that in the most recent 12 years, 11 of them have been the hottest on record. And then they go on to talk about, is this a natural cycle and variation, which does happen with climate, or is this man-made? And with 90% confidence and everyone agreeing, they said that this is man-made. And in fact, it's almost entirely man-made. There's a teeny component, which is, less than 10%, which might be natural. So if it is man-made, then we need to do something about what we're doing, and that's basically putting greenhouse gases out into the atmosphere. And the problem is the blame doesn't lie with any one sort of sector of the economy. It lies with everyone. And, you can't just sort of just point your finger at the coal industry, because we use the power that comes from those coal plants. So then what should we be doing? We should be looking to buy clean power. So I think that really that the power for change has to come from the people, and because this is a democracy, and I think that we need to start with ourselves. It's very difficult to sit there and convince other people to make change when you yourself are not doing something. But some of the steps are so simple. Here in North America, Canada and the U.S., we have something called Energy Star. All right. Energy Star is this thing where you can buy an appliance that's more energy efficient than others. I was recently at a conference with the Energy Star people, and we were going through their materials, and they were saying to me, we were looking down, and I noticed, I said, well, why don't you have any Energy Star dryers for clothes dryers? And they said, well, there are none. And I said, well, what do you mean there are none? And they said, well, there's no energy efficient way to dry your clothes. And I just sort of shook my head, and I wish I had it with me, but I've been showing it on some of my images. It's called a clothesline and clothes pegs. Okay, so would it absolutely kill us to go out there and dry our clothes on a clothesline and, I don't know, feel more countrified? I imagine this. Not the clothesline. No, we can't. No.
So, I got to say that, when I was a child, that's all there was clotheslines, and it was no big, huge problem.
Well, yeah, so my point and yours, I think, is that we could do that. All right, so there's a step. I could give you 20 others, and we could run down a list if you like. doing the compact fluorescent, walking 1 day out of 5, putting in a low flow shower head, all these things. So let's start with something that you do as an individual, take responsibility, own the problem, and then leverage that into something else, parlay that across. Robert Kennedy Jr. said yesterday, run for the school board or something. So once you make that change, then go out, talk to your neighbor, get involved at your work, look for something there. Call here in Oregon anyway, call up your governor and say, way to go to sign this agreement amongst the Western states. And I think that Arizona and one other in the South is involved in going for Kyoto, despite the lack of leadership at the federal administration level, and start to make those changes and the bigger changes. So create that movement. And then I think, make another individual change. And then I think go off and write a letter to your congressman. And so it starts small and build. It is a problem that is built by our everyday consumption of fossil fuels. The solutions will come from that level and working up. And we're best at the start to work on things like efficiency and conservation. And we will need regulation. We absolutely need it. We need leadership at the top. And all those things are important. I just think that, especially here in the United States, it's going to come from pressure at the bottom.
Yeah, well, particularly when the government's saying, well, we're not even too sure this is happening. I want to ask you, John Stryker, about the Canadian government and some particular things that are happening or not that are good or bad in Canada.
Okay, I'll just paint you a little bit of a picture. Canada did sign on to the Kyoto Protocol. Although when we did that, we didn't at that time start to make any real changes. Canada went through a great deal of economic growth between when we signed on, I think in 2000, and when and say a couple of years ago. And all that economic growth means that, actually I'm not sure what the numbers state today, but Canada is duking it out with the U.S. to be the worst emitters of greenhouse gases on a per capita basis. And so both of us more or less produce something like combined, we produce more than 1/4 of all the greenhouse gases globally, yet we represent only 1/20 of the world's population. So we're out of step. And so Canada was really not making a sincere effort. I went down and had meetings with parliamentary subcommittees and testified to them, basically telling them, get some real leadership in place here because you're not doing it. Then something happened a little over a year ago, say a year and a half ago, and that was the first meeting, the United Nations meeting, once Kyoto came into effect. So February 16th, 2005, Kyoto came into force because Russia signed on and that made it happen. And oh, boom, it's now law, international law. The next meeting that happened for the United Nations, they decided to put in Montreal. And this was a really big deal because it's right next door to the U.S. The U.S. is the key holdout. I mean, Australia's in there too, but really it's about the U.S. And so Canada really worked very hard at that. And there was the chair of that conference was the then environment minister. His name is Stéphane Dion. And he worked exceptionally well and hard at this. And the meetings were considered a very big success. However, within Canada at that time, we were just about to go into an election. And we switched governments and went from sort of a more liberal government to a more conservative government, and their first actions were to erode our work towards meeting Kyoto. When we just got to the point where we were starting to take leadership, put forward a good plan to deal with it, the next government stepped in and said no. And that was where it sat. And then a few things happened in a row. These major scientific reports came out. Al Gore's film An Inconvenient Truth came out, and the public groundswell started to happen in Canada. The next thing you know, the opposition party elected a new leader, and lo and behold, they elect Stéphane Dion, whose platform was all about a new economic model which relied on keeping the environment in balance. It's this new model, and it breaks the old model, the old argument of environment versus economic development, which is just a no-win situation. So the change has swung a bit, and all of the public opinion in Canada has now swayed the current administration, the Harper government, to actually start to address it more seriously. So it's back and forth. It's a real seesaw, and we don't know where it's going to end up. And I'm not down here trying to point fingers, because Canada is not in a position to do so. But I am here to try and encourage the American people to work on this, because America holds the balance of power on this issue globally.
As with so many different issues. So, well, our time is up, John Stryker. Would you like to give any contact information?
Sure. If you want to look us up on the web, you can go to the website of the Northern Climate Exchange, and that's taiga.net/NCE. And it's taiga.net/NCE. And taiga just means the boreal forest.
Say it one more time. I tried to write it down fast.
Yeah, okay. If you want more information, you can go to the Northern Climate Exchange's website, and that's taiga.net/NCE. That's taiga.net/NCE.
Okay. Well, thank you very, very much for this interview and for your work, John Stryker. Thanks a lot. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. To hear other programs produced by Sue Supriano, go to my website, www.suesupriano.com, spelled SUESUPRIANO. To order copies of my shows or to communicate with me, you can send me an email at sue@suesupriano.com. Again, Supriano is SUPRIANO. Thanks a lot.